Welcome to the Tour Life Podcast from Well Better Best. I'm Janine, your host, integrative nutrition health coach and personal trainer. In the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some of the most interesting and hardworking professionals in the music industry. Whether you are a fan of live music or someone who actually puts on the shows, you'll find some great stories, advice, and encouragement to live a happier, healthier life doing what you love. Today's guest is a music producer, playback engineer, live show designer, photographer, film producer, consultant, and activist who has worked with artists such as Pentatonix, Dua Lipa, Lana Del Rey, and The Lonely Island, just to name a few. In this episode, we discuss what live music executives and artists can do to care for their crews, the importance of learning emotional intelligence, and how nurturing your community can help fight post-tour depression and other mental health issues. You can find her on Instagram at Ray Zemmel. Here is my conversation with Raina Zemmel. Raina, thank you so much for joining me on the Tour Life podcast. I'm so excited to hear about you. You're friends with 5-1, which is amazing. I mean, he's one of the most amazing people that I've met over the past year. So tell me how you got started in the music industry. And did you always know that this is what you wanted to do?
Well, actually, no. This wasn't what I thought I was going to be doing. I went to college at University of Vermont and got my degree in political science and international relations. And the first time I ever came to Los Angeles, I was looking at law schools. I thought I was going to go into some type of aspect of the law. But while I was in college, I was playing in a punk rock band and working at a guitar store. And it was so much fun, you know, because being 18, 19, 20 years old, going on little tours and just playing loud, hard, fast music was great. And I decided that instead of going into law, I wanted to do something with music. So instead of going to law school, I went to LA Recording School and completed a 900-hour program for, you know, audio engineering. And then I just started doing odd jobs, as one has to do when they are first starting out in Los Angeles. And I eventually got hired at a recording studio, Paramount Recording. And they put me at another studio called Encore Recording, which is where I met my mentor, this guy named Che Pope. And this is when Dr. Dre was posted up, and he just kind of took me under my wing and gave me my first like real gig. And then I just started working in Atlantic Records as an engineer. I went back to LA Recording School and started working as a teacher. And then touring just kind of fell in my lap, as I think that seems to be a common thread with a lot of people that get into touring. It's just not something that you think that you're going to be doing. It just happens to you.
Take me back to when you decided that you were going to just completely switch lanes and get into music. Did you know that you could go to school for this?
Yes. I knew I could go to school for it, because they have a program for anything, any career that you could possibly think of. There's probably some type of school that will be more than willing to take your money to teach you how to do it. But as far as touring goes, when I actually was asked to go on my first tour, it was perfect timing. I was going through a breakup, and it was an offer for like a 9-month tour. And I said, great, I don't have to be at home for 9 months, you know, ruminating over this. So I took the opportunity, and that's all they wrote.
That's so interesting that you were kind of in a place where you were looking for a way out, a little distraction, and that's exactly what you got. Do you think that that's a theme?
Yes. I mean, that's the great thing about touring, is that if you have something in your life that you're trying to escape from, it's a really good path to do that. And every day is just, you have a singular focus, and your focus is doing your job, and that's it. And then That's all you have to think about. So it is very escapist. And I'm the first one to admit that this is a very escapist profession.
I'm interested in what happened on that first tour. So you were going through a breakup, which, you know, for most of us, I think is difficult. I mean, as much as we may not want to admit right at first, it is definitely difficult. And you had to make connections with a whole new group of people. You had to learn how to be on tour. What are some of the things that you discovered about yourself while you were on tour? And was it easy to see them?
I was told by a friend of mine to read Emotional Intelligence for Dummies, because when you are touring, you know, you have to deal with so many different personalities. And I came to a level of self-awareness where I realized that some of my, you know, idiosyncratic routines can be really annoying to other people around me, so that I should probably stop doing those. You know, I'm very extroverted. I've got, you know, a lot of personality. And I just realized that there's a lot of introverts that tour. And sometimes you can't really overwhelm them with just being in their face and just talking all the time. Sometimes you just got to chill out a little bit. And so it kind of taught me how to just read people, manage people's expectations, that type of thing.
How did your friend know that that's what you needed?
Probably because this friend of mine knew that I'm not an unintelligent person. You know, I like to think of myself as pretty intelligent. And so the technical aspect of what I do, I mean, I'm a playback engineer. So it is probably, out of all the jobs in the audio department of a tour, it's probably the most, I don't know, one that's wrought with the most amount of anxiety, because everybody else could fall off the stage, you know. But if something happens in my world, the show will stop. So you have to have if you're hardwired for stress and you like high intensity situations, it's perfect. So I know that about myself. So this person was probably like, you should read up on, you know, emotional intelligence. Probably could get something out of that. So I was like, maybe I should.
So are you saying that you found that you thrive on high energy and high expectations and pressure?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's almost like an addiction. The dopamine that I get from having a good show, like I'm getting chills on my arm, just like thinking about it, you know, it's that rush. It's palpable for me. And that is what I am attracted to. You know, I'm attracted to not only lifestyle, but also just the fact that there's so much pressure and so much on the line. And that when you do it really well, nobody cares, because, you know, the show went fine. And that's all that is important. But when the show, of course, doesn't go well, it's all always going to be my fault. But I really thrive in those types of situations. I really love the pressure and I love the stress. I don't know why. I don't know what's wrong with me. I just really love it.
Have you thought about why?
Well, you know, this summer, you know, I started documenting all the protests and I realized that, oh, this is very, very similar to these high stress, high intensity situations that I'm really missing right now, that, you know, because we're all grounded because of COVID. And my therapist was the first one to say that you might just be hardwired for stress. I think, you know, just the some conditions of what happened when you grew up, that's the type of thing that you're attracted to. And it's okay as long as you realize that that's what you're doing.
That's interesting. I definitely, definitely agree with your therapist about how our personality and our needs are definitely built on our experiences as children. Mm-hmm. I think it's nice that you were able to at some point realize that that's something that makes you and accept it. Was it always easy to accept it, or was it something you were shying away from?
No, it's something that I've always been very comfortable with. You know, luckily I had parents that were supportive of me doing reckless and dangerous and stupid things. So
that's so cool. And it's funny because a lot of these things, you know, I remember doing some pretty reckless things. I mean, I remember the first, I was with my ex, we weren't dating yet, but he invited me out to ACL. And I'm like, yeah, sure, a stranger. Like, I'll fly out across the country. Like, maybe I'll die. Maybe not. Who knows? Like, you know, but those sorts of things are kind of funny, right? Because they end up putting you into some really interesting paths. Mm-hmm. And I think it, like, some interesting trajectories where you may have otherwise missed. Tell me a little bit more about how you ended up since you were forced to step away from touring because of COVID, how you were able to find a place documenting the protests and how that trajectory has affected where you are today.
Well, I mean, I guess it started with the Ahmaud Arbery shooting. And where that happened in Georgia is not that far away from where my half brother lives, you know, and I'm half African American. And it just was obviously when you see these things, when you see these videos, you hear these stories, you know, as a person of color, you see yourself in these videos, and this is why they're so disturbing. And so because we were grounded because of COVID, I feel like that is the reason why I had the bandwidth to really like be like, wait, this is messed up. And I have a camera, you know, I just bought a camera at the beginning of last year because I was supposed to go on a tour and go to these amazing, beautiful places, and a cell phone camera wasn't going to cut it. So I bought a camera, and I just decided to take my camera and go out and start documenting these protests. And part of the reason I did that is because I was seeing how the mainstream media was constructing the narrative of what this uprising was. And they were focusing so heavily on the destruction of property, when that to me felt like such a side note. It seemed almost inconsequential to me that they are focusing on how terrible it is that, you know, that these police precincts are burning down, that these Target stores are burning down, that these big box retail stores are burning down, but failing to recognize that these things don't happen in a vacuum. This is obviously built up, and this is a response to, you know, just generations of injustice. And part of the reason I went out and grabbed my camera and decided to go out on the front lines is because I was just really pissed off about the way that these uprisings were being portrayed in the media. So I wanted to get an on the boots, you know, on the ground type of view, because most people now are getting their news from social media. So if I could just show like what's going on and how police are acting, then more people will be a little bit more apt to be on board with, you know, defunding the police, abolishing police, reimagining what policing could be in the United States.
Yeah, I remember over the summer. So I live right next to a town named Griffith. It's in Indiana. And there, you know, over the past few years, especially under Trump, there was this one particular bar that was super racist. I mean, the owner was racist. Like, she had grabbed them by the pussy, like on the, like on her marquee. And there was lots of incidences of racism. And there was a protest, what we thought was going to be a protest that was going to happen that was going to start like at the park. And it was really interesting because I wanted to kind of go see it. And my whole mentality was like, well, you know, we've been trying to bring attention to what this business owner is doing. And, you know, maybe we'll end up like in front of her business protesting. Like, that was kind of, you know, where I was at. Well, I show up to the park and it was completely different, right? It was more of just like a get together where people had a discussion. It was super peaceful. There were families there. I mean, it was amazing. But as we were driving through, there was a SWAT team, there was a helicopter, there were like tons of cop cars, you know, just parked down at the YMCA for no reason at all. When you talk about the difference between the perception and how the media portrays all of these things, and even just race relations as a whole, it's very clear to me the way that there's a discrepancy between reality and the way that people think things actually are. What are some of the things that you discovered in documenting these events?
Well, I mean, I didn't really discover this. It just confirmed this, that I have no love for any police whatsoever. I've been tear gassed 23 times. I probably am suffering from some type of low key PTSD. It was the third protest I went to, and it was the Fairfax riot. And this was an event that was sponsored by, it was put on by Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, and it was supposed to be just a couple hundred people, but everybody in LA turned up. It was insane. And I saw LAPD parking decoy cars and setting them on fire to rile up the crowd. And there was these, they had these buckets full of rocks and bricks that were underneath bus stop seats, and they're placed there by police. So it will give them justification for using excessive force against protesters. So after that day, it was such a crazy day. I mean, it was the first time I ever got tear gas. You know, I'm like running around. I'm scared out of my mind. The last time I got tear gas, I was like, I just put my mask on. I turned my back and I walked calmly away, you know? So the first time as opposed to the last time. But it was, it's to me, it just seems like the solution is just so simple. Just stop killing people indiscriminately. Like, it seems so simple. But the fact that police are fighting so hard to be able to have a license to basically murder people without any type of accountability, there's something deeply flawed with our entire policing system. And I think it is so bad that it cannot be reformed at this point. I did a lot of self-educating, and I learned about the history of policing in America and how it started as slave catching in the South and in the North, in the Northern part of the United States, it started as union breaking. So it's the emphasis of police in America has always been to protect property over people. And I think that's honestly why they put protect and serve in quotes, to protect and serve.
I mean, it's disgusting how the anger that you hear from people about property being destroyed. How can you even equate that with a human life, first of all?
I don't understand either. I mean, I remember that first week of the uprisings, and people are like, you know, it's terrible that, you know, George Floyd was killed like this, but the looting and the property destruction needs to stop. And I just remember thinking, like, that's totally opposite. It needs to be, this property destruction is really awful, but the killing of unarmed Black people needs to stop. That's the real issue. It's not, why are we protecting property and why are we putting that above the value of human life?
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's a conversation that is being forced. And I've always been one to think that sometimes when you force conversations, things get messy. And that's the way that you get people to pay attention. And I think that's the way that it's happened in history. That's the way that it's happened in other countries. That's the way that change is made, by forcing people to pay attention. Because, I mean, even if you just look at the news today, there's other things that distract everybody. And there's other ways to ignore the conversation and ignore all of these things that were happening, to make them seem like they were just little blips in time and that we're over it and we're done and we've moved on, which I think is how our country has really approached, you know, racism as a whole. Like they always look at it as something that happened in the past, something that's not there anymore, something that's different. You know, we're all different now. And I think it's complete bullshit.
Yeah, we had a Black president, so racism is officially done.
Oh my gosh. And I could go on forever. I love that you went out and you actually did something. For people who tour, I think it's something that you were used to doing every day, right? Like actually going out and doing something, getting something done at the end of the day, every single day, and then finding yourself in a place where you couldn't do that anymore. And then finding yourself in another place where you actually could again. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, part of the when COVID hit and all the tours were grounded, I was in a dark place. I mean, I'm sure everybody was. But a lot of that was because I was missing my community. You know, I love touring because I love I love being with people. I love the relationships that I form. You know, it's almost similar to like military service, you know, because you're with these group of people. And I was missing that. And so when I started, you know, going to these protests and documenting them, I have met more people in the 6 months that I've been documenting these protests and doing and participating in various mutual aid efforts here in Los Angeles. I've met more people doing this in the past 6 months than I have in the 10 years that I've lived in Los Angeles. And these are all people that are like high quality, you know, very like-minded. We just want to help. And this is really the most important thing that we can be doing right now. Because everything, all these inequities, it's not just racial, you know, it's not just racism, but it's just, you know, it's classism. It's economic, you know, inequities. All these things existed before COVID. COVID just shined a light, and it was like a stress test in all of our infrastructures. And clearly we failed because our infrastructures aren't strong enough to keep people safe and also keep industry going and also keep people safe from, you know, the government, so to speak. You know, we're talking today and Mitch McConnell just basically blocked the $2,000 stimulus check, and this guy's worth like $24 million. So these things have always existed, but COVID, now that everything has stopped, we are now having to reckon with the fact that things have been bad in our society for a long time. And now we really have to deal with it. Otherwise, things are going to get worse, I think.
Yeah, I love that you said that it shines a light. And that's how I describe Trump to people. I'm like, you know, he's just the black light that has shined on our country that just reveals all the dirty spots.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that he got elected, you know, he got elected because people were really pissed about Obama being president for 8 years. They did not like that.
Yeah, totally. So what do you think we can do? I feel like a theme of community is something that's coming up.
So now more than ever, you know, mutual aid is so important because clearly we can't rely on Congress or the Senate to pass anything that's going to help people in any type of meaningful ways. So for me personally, what that's meant is going down to Skid Row a couple days out of the week and just organizing like immediate needs, you know, like food, water, feminine hygiene products, you know, soap, hand sanitizer, masks, just getting people the immediate necessities that they need. Because this is how people are this is how people are surviving right now. People that aren't homeless, you know, there's a lot of food banks that are seeing record numbers of people that are coming in for food. So at the end of the day, community is really all you have to back you up. So that's why I think it's so important that we make sure to build up our communities. And we haven't had to do that in the past, especially with the isolated way that we live our lives, you know, just in general. You know, we're very separate from each other. And now we're realizing that community is what will see you through this. These are going to be the people that are going to check in on you. We haven't heard from you in a while. Are you okay? You know, if you get arrested during a protest, these are the people that you're going to call to maybe bail you out, you know, or at least start a GoFundMe, you know, something like that. You know, I've been protesting with this group of people, and I have a Google Doc with all of our, you know, our government names, our addresses, our phone numbers, our next of kin, you know, basically who do we contact in case one of us disappears or gets disappeared. And I've never had that type of network before, but I don't know. It's like you run from the sheriff's department, you know, and they're using so much tear gas that it's now wafting into the neighborhood, you know, and people that have their windows open in the middle of summer are now getting tear gas coming through their windows. It's like, once you go through these traumatic experiences together, it's like, okay, well, what do you need? Are you good? Are you okay? If you're not, let me know. And so community is what is going to get us through this, honestly. That's what I think.
Have you thought about the lasting impact of these interactions and the fact that PTSD is, I mean, it's something that's happening to all of us in various different ways. I mean, for you, getting to your guest, period, like that's going to cause some sort of anxiety, right? But also not having resources that you typically would, not being able to touch people the way we normally would, not being able to be close to people. What are you seeing in that aspect?
I mean, I feel that I've been really lucky through this whole thing. This has been a traumatic year, but it's also been a year of incredible gratitude. You know, I got married this year, you know, so I'm not quarantining by myself. You know, I have a roof over my head. I live comfortably. I'm not, you know, I'm not stressed about where my rent is coming from. But as far as like the long-term lasting effects are, I think like a lot of other people, I definitely got radicalized this year. You know, I was definitely, you know, center to left, and I feel that that's the center is now, there is no center. The center did not hold. I am now completely far on the left. And it's funny because at first when I really started getting into this, I thought that this was going to have some negative consequences on my career, you know, because I post all this stuff on Instagram and I get hired, honestly. I've gotten jobs. People are like, yeah, I saw your Instagram. I just, you know, playback engineer and your name popped up and looks like you do a lot of stuff. So what's your availability like? And so they're going to go on my page and see like, you know, fuck the police. Yeah. So, I mean, I thought this was going to have some really negative repercussions, but people started reaching out to me being like, hey, do you want to help us like do a phone bank for Joe Biden? And while I'm not a huge Joe Biden fan, I don't really think that anything is going to fundamentally change under Joe Biden. I was like, yeah, sure. Like whatever I can do to help, because I just need to like get this guy out of office.
You know? Yeah, you're like, when it's that bad, I mean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, today as we're recording, it's like we need Georgia to save us from Kentucky right now. I mean, this is the point that we're at in American history. It's just been a wild year, man.
It's funny that you mentioned the whole social media thing because, you know, I was a teacher for a while. It had been almost 4 years that I was teaching. And one of the main reasons why I was like, I can't do this forever was because I felt the need to be quiet about my, you know, my political views and I mean, just my attitude. I have I'm very impulsive and I have an anarchy tattoo on my middle finger.
I know, I saw that. I was like, okay.
It's like, you know, but like, that's the type of shit where like, oh, hey guys, I'm your high school Spanish teacher. And you know, the kids would see stuff like that. And it's just like, it was really hard for me to hide who I really was. And, you know, I totally get how we have been conditioned to really be scared of putting out there like our actual views. But something that I've found over the past few years is that at the end of the day, like that's how you're going to find your people.
Exactly. I mean, I got a lot of really positive responses. They're like, wow, thank you for doing the work. And I'm like, I'm just going out and I'm taking pictures. Like I'm not organizing these. I'm just going, I'm not the one that's like wearing shields or like, you know, fully decked out in black block. I'm just making sure that if anybody needs like evidence against a police brutality case, then they can come to me if they need that, you know. But yeah, being unapologetic about where you stand. I think at the end of the day, it's more of a helpful thing as opposed to being a hindrance, because people know where you stand and you've got conviction and there is a moral compass that guides you, you know.
The whole being afraid of showing who you really are, I think, is something that has been a roadblock in progressing all, you know, in every aspect. But also, if you think about it in the music industry, I mean, or even just entertainment, I mean, look at what was happening in Hollywood about women speaking out about abuse and things like that. But now I feel that if we're able to be ourselves and if we're able to speak out on things and really show the world our true selves, it opens up the door to communicating about the really difficult and uncomfortable things.
Yes, I 100% agree with you. I think if anything, the fact that our whole industry was shut down, now we can start having these conversations about these inequities that exist just within the live music industry. You know, the fact that I'm paying a ridiculous amount of money for health insurance. And why isn't there some type of union? You know, like, why is it that every other branch of the entertainment industry has some type of union, some type of representation, except for touring individuals? There's got to be a way that we can fix this. Touring makes what, like $2.1 billion a year? There's no reason why we can't pull some of those profits to make sure that the people that are actually making these shows happen can get adequate healthcare and adequate access to mental health care, which is another huge issue in our industry, is like the mental health toll that, you know, just touring takes on you in general. So yes.
Tell me a little bit more about the mental health toll. How has that manifested in your experience?
Well, I discovered that post-tour depression is really real. it's a thing. You know, I haven't really had like bouts of like depression before, but I remember coming back from my first tour and feeling like a dog who's been left in a crate all day, and they start howling because they don't know where the rest of their pack is, and will they ever come back home, and what's going to happen? Is everything going to be okay? Are we okay? Is everything going to be okay? That's how I felt after my first tour. I was like, why do I feel so down and anxious and just not happy? And I realized that, oh, it's because I am suffering from post-tour depression. It's really real. And I read this book a couple years ago called Tribe by this author named Sebastian Unger. And it's about PTSD in American soldiers. And the whole thesis of this book is that the reason why American soldiers suffer from PTSD uniquely from other soldiers from other countries is not because of what they experience in wartime situations. It's actually the life that they return to when they get home. So when you are in the military, you're with your people, you know, there's no separation. You're with your community. You're living in such a manner that human civilization has really lived for up until about 300 years ago. If you think about it, like, we've always lived in these very close knit tribes, you know, with multi-generational families living all together. And it's been, you know, relatively recently that, you know, we've lived very separate from each other, away from, you know, away from our immediate family. And so his whole hypothesis was that the reason why American soldiers suffer from PTSD so badly is because they come back to a lifestyle that's very isolated, which is completely different from the way that they live when they're in wartime situations. And it's also very, it's like the antithesis to the way that humans have evolved. So this is where that PTSD comes from. So it still happens. It happened on my last tour. You know, it happens every single tour. I get sad. The anxiety is a little bit less because I now more than before in the past, I'm like, okay, I've got another job lined up, so I don't have that anxiety. But it's just like, I miss my people. You know, I'm still on a food pun text thread from 5 years ago where we just like do food puns, you know?
But that's what keeps you connected, right?
Exactly. You know? So the mental health thing is it's that post-tour depression. I understand why people, you know, drink or do drugs. It's because you're trying to numb yourself from feeling these feelings. And then you numb yourself to such a point where you're just like, wow, I would like to feel feelings again. And then you feel all the feelings. You're like, oh, nope, I got to stop this. So it's like this negative, you know, this negative cycle.
Something that I find really interesting is that you mentioned that whole dynamic of like the American way of life, which is basically our entire adolescence. We're just thinking about the way that we're going to leave our parents and like what we're going to do to like go away and move across the country. Mm-hmm. And then we have these modular families that basically, you know, you have the mom and the dad and maybe a sibling, maybe. I mean, I was practically an only child most of my life. My brother wasn't born until I was almost 10. And my family, and we're immigrants. And so it was really interesting because I feel like with immigrant families, it's one way or another, right? Either you're still really close to your family, especially if you live in a bigger city. But if you live like in a suburban type of life, you're actually very distant from your family. But that definitely has a big impact on the way that our mental health is affected overall, because it's I noticed, at least for me, it was harder to connect with people because I wasn't close to my extended family. It was kind of like, it was always a very like individual type of lonely life. I don't want it to sound super depressing or anything, but it's totally different from like my family in Mexico. I mean, everybody was close. Like there was one point where like my aunt had she got a job that was closer to like my uncle's house. So they just traded homes. I mean, like that sort of thing just happens all the time, right? Or like, and you have like multi-generational homes all the time. And so it is, I feel like I always witnessed it to be like a happier life, even if they didn't necessarily have all the luxuries that we did here. Mm-hmm. So is that kind of like what you're getting at too, that maybe has an effect on the way that we handle being alone?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at least my personal metric for happiness is the health of my relationships with people, you know, and it doesn't matter how much they can try to sell you on this, like owning things will not fill the void that people and interactions create within you. There's no thing that can substitute that. So yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, that isolation, being away from family. I mean, I'm very close with my extended family and they all live in Pennsylvania and I'm here in Los Angeles. And this year has been super hard because I haven't been able to see my family. And it also makes me really thankful that I have a family that misses me, you know, and that I have a family to miss and that, you know, there's people out there that care about me. But yeah, it's this American way of living, which is, it's like this rugged individualism. It's this reason why there's this mask debate, you know, like, well, no, it's my body, my rights, you know, it's like, no, let's think about what's good for the greater collective. Like maybe it's not always about what's important for you individually. Maybe it's about what's important for you in the context of everybody else in society, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really a culture change that needs to happen, I think, across the board. But it was interesting because I did a webinar. What's today? Today's Tuesday. So yesterday.
I'm like, day of March.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't even know. But anyway, so yesterday. Yeah. But yesterday, you know, there was a question that came up and it was, how can people in the music industry work toward a better industry that cares about people's well-being and, you know, humans? And I mentioned something about how it's really important for, number one, to fit it in the budget. So like the people who are in charge of budgets need to care. So they need to make sure that the routing's okay. So you don't have like back-to-back shows and you can't think about anything other than work multiple days in a row. So, you know, that's one thing, right? But it kind of placed a lot of the responsibility at the top. But I think it's also really important to understand that it's like, it's a culture thing. And at the individual level, we have the ability to communicate and care about each other in a way that allows this culture of caring for each other to grow, so that instead of having, you know, little camps and like little silos throughout the industry, kind of just taking care of themselves, everyone can kind of communicate in a way that it creates a bigger family and a better culture of caring overall. Does that sort of make sense, like what I'm getting at?
It does, but I would say that I think that a lot of the responsibility is top down, you know? I mean, For example, after 40 years of trickle-down Reaganomics, we have finally realized that it doesn't work. Like, you can't like just trickle down from the top and hope that it gets to the bottom. No. Wealth always wants to consolidate at the top, and then you kind of get, and people at the bottom get the scraps. And that model is very prevalent in the music industry. You know, you've got artists and they make a lion's share of, you know, the profits, and then, you know, and then it gets trickled down to the people that work for the artists. And I think what actually needs to happen is that there needs to be, I think as individuals in the music industry, we do need to start organizing ourselves so we have some type of collective bargaining, because there's no HR department in tours. You know, I am the only woman of color, queer woman of color, playback engineer in the entire industry. And yeah, it's cool because while I'm super visible, but it sucks being the only person because I'm just like, you know, I'm half Jewish, I'm half Black. So it's like everything will offend. And I'm also gay, you know, so it's like there's so many different levels that I can be offended on, you know. So and if I am working with someone who is, say, I don't know, making, this was a tour I was on like a year and a half ago, and there was a guy who kept making jokes about going to Nazi rallies. And I was like, you do understand that, like, this was like right after that synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. And my mom knew people at that synagogue who went there. And I was like, this isn't funny. Like, people die as a result of like jokes like this. And it's always under the context. Oh, it's just a joke. No, it's not just a joke. You don't make jokes about, you know, about a fascist party that was responsible for the death of 11 million people. It's not funny. But as individuals, if we had some type of collective bargaining, then we could say like, hey, this type of behavior is not acceptable because it's written into the bylaws of our contract, you know? So I started working with some individuals on this project called Global One Live. And it's basically a campaign that's supported by the IATSE Stagecraft Department with authorization from the president. And we are working on getting contracts for individual crews. And they're ready to go now. And for literally like $10 a day per crew member for people that are part of the immediate, like that are hired by the bands, like front of house, you know, playback, monitors, you know, the people that are always touring or always traveling with the band for one-offs, you know, in addition to tours. For $10 a day per person, management could provide just catastrophic care for their employees, which would be great. If you really want to show your workers that you care, don't say thank you. You know, don't say like, thanks for doing it. No.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Yes, free health insurance. That's all I want at the end of the day. I just want some freaking health insurance.
Yeah. You know, and the whole, you know, I do think there is a responsibility at the individual level to give a shit, number one, right? So it's important for your tour manager to care. It's important for everyone who's, you know, in charge of the tour to care. It's important for you to demand respect, number one. You know, and one of the ways I think to do that is to have conversations so that everyone's on the same page and nobody is allowing themselves to get taken advantage of on the individual level. However, like you said, and that's a point that I did make. It's like we like to do this thing where we put all of the responsibility on the people, but the people who have the ability to actually make something happen don't do anything about it.
It's not in their interest to do anything about it.
Yeah, it's like the whole capitalism, right? Like you have people that run around saying, "Oh, well, if we had socialism, we'd all have bread lines." Well, how funny that the bread lines are still there, but they're not being funded by the government. Yeah. You know, how ironic.
I know. It's so funny how like socialism has been such a dirty word when it, like, they do socialism all the time for big industry. Like, they've been bailing out banks since the 20s. You know what I mean? But as soon as it's like, it boggles my mind that the people that were involved in the Enron scandal in like the early 2000s that were responsible for the deaths of people, like, because of the rolling blackouts, I mean, people's lives were destroyed because of that. That is less offensive than giving people a stimulus check so they can make sure that they have a roof over their head just for the next couple months. How did we get here? You know?
It's funny because, you know, we're seeing all of these parallels between, you know, our country as a whole, right? Our entire culture and the way that our structures are, and they're put in place in order to make sure that we don't rise up and that we don't demand more. And I think it's really important to understand how that shows a parallel within each industry that is within that government structure. Mm-hmm. I think moving forward, it's really important for us to show people that we do have agency and we do have the ability to make a change. And we really just have to demand it, because at the end of the day, the people who are putting on the shows are the people doing the work. And that's how the money's being made, period. So who's really in control here?
I mean, technically, I could say that I'm the one in charge, because I can press stop and the show will stop. You know, I press the stop button, I'm like, all right, there's no show. And like when I first started off, like my very first tour, I did not have that sense of, you know, agency, because I was green. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know that I'm allowed to say no to certain things, that there's certain things that were being asked of me were not in my job description. And I wasn't getting paid to say, you know, do stage managing and, you know, be a runner and also be like a tour production assistant. Like, no, I was hired to do backline and playback. Why am I doing all this other stuff? Well, I didn't know that that was something that I could say no to. And it took me years to like be in a place where I felt comfortable enough with my technical abilities to do my job, as well as the relationships that I cultivated with people, to say no, I'm not going to do that. Or just say, no, if you want me to do this, then we need to renegotiate what my day rate is going to be. And I think for a lot of people that are starting off, I think this is probably a very common thread, is that when you're starting off, you just want to make sure that that people like you, that you do a good job. Especially me, I'm feeling that pressure even more, because God, if I have to hear, wow, this is the first time I've ever seen you're the first female playback engineer I've ever seen. I'm like, don't forget, I'm the only black one too. I think there's like there's four other female playback engineers. I know I'm definitely the only one of color. So it's like you just want to make sure that you get hired for your next job. So you don't want to be too squeaky of a wheel, but sometimes that can be a detriment because you get taken advantage of, because you always say yes to things. So I think if there was like, you know, collective, if there was like an HR department to be like, no, wait, that's not in her job description, then it kind of offsets that responsibility on the individual to management, which I think it's like that whole argument that people were making when climate change was really starting to get into the cultural vernacular. It's like, well, this is what we can do individually to help combat climate change. No, it's not about like changing your light bulbs. It's about like, you know, the agricultural industry being responsible for like 70% of like the greenhouse gas emissions. There's no way that me changing my light bulbs to like is going to offset that. Like, come on.
And you know, you're not the only one that has brought up this theme of having a you know, what we would call in any other industry, just HR, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really having that neutral person that is only in charge of making sure that that protocol is being met and that people are being taken care of and that nobody's getting taken advantage of. And that hasn't existed. And I think the nature of people in touring, where most of the time you're a 1099 contractor, and you really don't have any protections because of that, I think that's where one of the problems lies. And I find it really upsetting that more and more of our economy is turning into this gig worker freelance sort of situation. And I don't think it's leading to anywhere good. And I feel like it may be time for us to demand a little bit more so that it doesn't happen. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that companies don't want to be responsible for people.
No. I mean, that was part of the reason why this bill hasn't been able to pass, because they don't want to offset the responsibility of protecting workers from COVID onto companies. They want to offset that onto the workers, which is, I mean, essential workers are making what, like $15 an hour at a grocery store, and you want to put
if they're lucky,
and then you want to put the responsibility of not catching COVID when they're interacting with the public onto them, when there is, say, the company that they're working for is a chain that is making billions of dollars a year. Why is that responsibility always being put on the people that have the least amount of power? And I think that's where the opportunity in this time is. So where we are right now with COVID happening, and it's shining a light on all these cracks in our infrastructure. Now that everybody's grounded, nobody's, you know, traveling around the world, you know, completely distracted by whatever tour is going on, whatever job they're doing. Now we can be like, wait, we can do better than this. You know, there's definitely a way that, you know, artists can still make the money that they want to make, and also workers can be protected from, you know, from being harassed, from, you know, from sexual harassment, from racial harassment, from, you know, like the last tour I was on, I had a tooth that came out. Like I had a crown that came out, and thank God I was on a tour that had a great production crew that was just like, all right, I went to their office at 10:30 in the morning. I was like, hey, my tooth fell out. I was in Australia. My health insurance doesn't cover me when I'm in Australia. It was going to be like $600 to get it fixed. And he was like, no, we can't have you, like, we can't have you not being 100%. Went into the office at 10:30 a.m. By 12 p.m. or I was in a dentist chair, and by 2 p.m. I was back on, you know, back at the show. But I got lucky because I was touring with a band that really takes care of its people. Not everybody is that lucky. So I think that there needs to be a protocol in place to protect people, because the responsibility, having it being shifted onto the workers, clearly isn't working. It's not working on a national scale. You know, this is why we're seeing all of the unrest that we're seeing right now, is because of the responsibility of powering the economy falling on workers when they get a sliver percentage of the actual wealth that they are producing for the top 1%.
100%. And I think this is a theme that needs to continue, and we need to continue the conversation, and we need to start demanding more, period. I mean, there's nothing else to it. So what is something that you would say to everyone that also recognizes that there's an issue and that we need to handle it, and we need to do it while we still can, while everybody's grounded?
I think honestly, this issue of a union, I think is probably the most important, because if anything, you know, the word union has kind of been made into a dirty word, because a lot of people, it's almost like the way that the police have worked, you know, it's like it needs to be reformed, you know, the way that especially like the IATSE works, and, you know, the local crews and, you know, whatnot. But I think that there needs to be in place some type of structure that at least gives health insurance to people that tour, that for touring crews, because of the fact that it takes such a toll on you physically. You know, you don't, there's a lot of times where I've gone a couple of days without sleeping, you know, or where I've had a show at like a show that starts at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and then I have to be up at six for an 8 a.m. flight, you know, to go back into rehearsals, you know. And then you do that for like a month straight, and then your body is just a wreck after that. So something to address the fact that people need health insurance. People need health insurance to combat the mental fatigue and the mental stress that happens, that is so prevalent within our industry. I mean, the suicide rates for touring individuals is like much higher than it is for most other industries. There is something inherently wrong with that. So I think that just if we just get healthcare, that's all I want. If there's anything that I want for 2021, it's healthcare for everybody in touring. So we can all get the health insurance that we need, that we can all get the help that we need. So that when this happens again, you know, there's going to be more pandemics. It's just the nature of the beast, that we won't be caught with our proverbial pants down and we won't be in such a quandary that we're in right now. It would be nice if when there's another disaster that we're not on the brink of like a revolution every single time. I feel like, okay, we got this. I mean, they're having concerts right now in Australia and New Zealand. You know, and it's not like these governments are run by capitalists that are like any better. They just understand that there needs to be a society in order to function. You know, you have to pay people. You have to make sure that you're not taking away their health insurance in the middle of a global pandemic. So I think that's just the end of the day. I just want health insurance. Hi, I'm Raina Zemel. I would just like health insurance.
I completely agree. And there were so many times in the past few years where I was like, you know, if I just didn't need health insurance, I could do what I really wanted.
Right. If I just didn't need to go to a dentist, you know, if I didn't need to go to a doctor, things would be fine. Then I could do these reckless things like, you know, run in front of, you know, police barricades.
Well, you know, I think you definitely are an example of the heart and the soul of the entertainment industry. I mean, I feel like we're all misfits and we're all people who are willing to fight for what's right. And we're willing to fight. And at the end of the day, somebody's got to do it because change needs to come. And I think the more that we speak out about it, and the better and the faster it's going to happen. And I encourage anybody who's listening that wants to join the conversation to reach out to people. If you know anyone who is influential, if you know anybody who can help, anybody who has experience with these things, who knows how to get insurance, you know, anything like that, please have the conversation and try to connect with people who can work together to make it happen. Because if we go back to one of the main things that I think is helping everybody through this, and you too, Raina, is community. So let's work toward growing a stronger community and actually getting some shit done.
Oh yeah, let's do the work.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It was an amazing talk. It was so nice getting to know you a little bit. We'll talk soon.
Likewise. It was lovely meeting you too.
Bye.
Bye.
Here are some key takeaways from my conversation with Raina Zemel. 1. When you don't agree with the narrative that is being constructed, allow yourself to help shape a new narrative. Use your talents to raise awareness, and don't be afraid to show the world where you really stand and who you really are. 2. Community is important. It's what will give you the power to fight for a cause. It's what will see you through tough times, whether it's a grand scale injustice or another bout of post-war depression. 3. Things will never fill the void that people and human interactions do. There is no thing that can ever substitute that. Cherish your family and friends and make time to see them or talk to them as often as possible. Schedule it into your day. 4. Don't ever underestimate how important it is to speak and listen with emotional intelligence and kindness. Be aware of those around you. Words matter. And 5, if you really want to show your workers that you care and that they matter, put your money where your mouth is and take care of them. Provide them with some damn healthcare. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tour Life podcast. Be sure to give Raina a follow on Instagram @RayZemel and to check out the film We Can't Breathe, which has been selected to the Racial Equity Short Film Program at the Oscar-qualifying 45th Annual Cleveland Film Festival. And don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and to follow The Tour Life on Instagram at The Tour Life Podcast.